working now at a kind of strange-sounding museum, of Comparative Zoology. What's that?
That is a very old scientific museum, might be one of the oldest in the country, at Harvard University, where they it's essentially a research, teaching and research museum. And they cover everything from entomology, ants, to dinosaur bones, I mean paleontology, ethnobotany, looking at carbon deposits from 800 million years ago to determine if they were put down by plants or whatever. I mean, it's quite remarkable what they do.
Well, certainly your background didn't prepare you for a job.
No, my background there is really, it's kind of a public relations job. In some degree, I'm working with the friends of the MCC, and we run all kinds of membership programs, but we also run natural history trips all over the world, and they're extremely good trips. And if I get a chance to give them a plug on this program, I certainly will. But
you have a newspaper background as well, don't you?
I have a newspaper background, mostly a newspaper background, yeah. Mm-hmm. With everything from the Boston Herald to the Worcester Telegram to the Montgomery Advertiser.
What was it like working in radio?
Radio was, the job I had, I think, was an unfortunate one in some ways. I was editorial director, and I don't think there was enough for me to do. And I think I would have enjoyed it much more if I'd gotten on air and if I'd done some research on stories and gotten involved. As it was, I was a little bit like the king's scribe. I was sort of kept in an office, and I would come up with these pronouncements, and the king would read them. And that was, you know.
But radio station managers have traditionally been rather timid, haven't they?
I think so. Timid and
of course, not my own station manager. He's not timid.
Of course.
If he happens to hear this broadcast.
This is Donald. Well, I probably shouldn't mention any names. I don't know. It was not a matter of timidity. I thought, in some ways, he was a little bit opportunistic, and I felt some of the editorials were cheap shots. Any time it ever came into any kind of conflict with either his political pals or with the station's finances, we always took the high ground. We never sort of went at it. So I had a feeling, anyway, we were working in radio, that it at least in that position. I think radio has changed an awful lot since then, though.
Well, the nice thing about the editorial director's job is that you can take long lunch hours.
In fact, that's kind of what it came down to. And following the long lunch hours, one wasn't much good for anything for the rest of the afternoon, as I remember properly.
You didn't throw up in your boss's car, did you?
No, but I was with a couple of friends in high school when we were driving some girlfriends into Boston to take the train to come back to Manhattanville, and we got into the family wine cellar. And coming back, there was a couple of incidences which were reminiscent of that scene. And we had borrowed the family car, too, my girlfriend's family car. And we left it rather a mess. So that everything, I think, has a little bit of a preamble.
Well, I like the story investments best because I think everybody has kind of wanted to throw up in his boss's office or something.
Right. I think that's a fundamental human. It's a somehow denigrate, or one could say desecrate, authority.
You denigrate yourself, you desecrate authority.
Oh, okay, I suppose, yeah. I think in that case it's a matter of, it came down to a kind of ultimate body language, if you will.
I like that. Well, now you have this journalistic background. You went to Harvard.
Right.
You have a journalistic background. You worked in radio, but somewhere there lurked in your blood the desire to perpetrate fiction on the world, and thank God, because you've created a wonderful book with investments, but you must have had some sort of literary orientation prior to your getting into journalism.
I don't think journalism precludes literary interests. In fact, I would be willing to bet that journalists, by and large, have a almost natural interest in literature, one form or another. When you stop and think about the journalists who in fact became writers, everybody from Stephen Crane to Hemingway. I think there's a natural link there. And I think what happens is when you start writing, as a journalist does, and you get to a point, and I think this actually happened at WEI in Boston, the editorials got quite easy to write, and so easy that one was always looking for something a little tougher to do. And also, I left CBS and went to work for the Worcester Telegram and wrote stories there, but even those got easy after a while. And it seemed to me that once you build up a certain amount of momentum as a writer, that you just kept looking for something more difficult. And I think fiction is, by far, at least for me, the toughest thing to write. Poetry would probably be even more difficult, but I haven't tried it enough to really know.
Well, one nice thing about poetry is that there aren't very many standards. It's judged differently than fiction, so you can get away with just about anything.
Joseph Brodsky would vehemently disagree with you, and
he would say
that there are no standards for novelists. I wonder sometimes if Joseph Brodsky maybe tried to write a novel and went back to poetry.
I was talking to Robert Treatley, the semi-beat poet once, and he wrote a poem called What What? That was it, What What? And I said, what would possess you to write a little line like that and claim that it's poetry? He says, I don't have to justify it. So poets don't have to justify anything. Novelists do. Poets don't have to worry too much because they're not going to get published. But novelists usually write to get published. So there are different standards, and they're higher in many respects. Although poetry is tough. I mean, there's no question about it. The poetry that we read in college, reading Robert Lowell, as a matter of fact, there's a whole cottage industry surrounding Robert Lowell. There are more books about Lowell and his work than there are books by Lowell himself.
Yes, and that's the same is true of Frost, and probably it's going to be true of Seamus Heaney. I have a feeling, though, that poets do write to get published. I'm not too sure they always write to get read. And I think in a lot of new fiction, I wonder sometimes it's coming out of the fiction writing courses. I wonder how many of those writers are actually writing to be read, at least writing to be read by ordinary educated readers. I have sometimes they're writing to be read by other writers, and I see that as a trend. And that's something I quite consciously try to stay away from in my own writing. I actually try to write I write for myself, obviously, but I also write very much for the reader. I place a great deal of emphasis on entertainment value. When I say entertainment, I'm not talking about simple yucks, and I'm not talking about easy eroticism. I'm talking about trying to grab somebody and hold them with words. And I think, at least for me, that's one of the most difficult things to do, and the thing that takes time.
Well, you said something very interesting, and I think it was correct, that these younger writers write for each other. I think writers probably have always written for each other. But a lot of people from the Iowa Writers' Workshop pass through these microphones, and I usually ask about what other writers are influenced them, and they almost always mention people like Ann Beattie. Mm-hmm. They're mentioning people their age.
Right.
Rarely do they say, well, there's Hemingway, there's Faulkner. These writers don't influence them anymore. It's writers on their own level who influence them, and they write for each other, and they compare styles and this sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
I think.
And it all turns out to be the same style, I think. To some extent, it's a kind of flat, minimalist, which doesn't do anything for me.
They're all imitating Carver.
Right.
Carver's the one to imitate today, but he is good.
Oh, he's excellent, but I think that's sometimes the trouble, is somebody who's very good at one particular school isn't, I mean, Nabokov is brilliant at what he does, but how many people can actually imitate Nabokov, set him up as a model? I mean, I think some people have tried, and they invariably stumble. He that was his own métier. And I think to some extent that's true with that minimalist school, too. It does take a carver, somebody who's absolutely driven and obsessive, to bring that off. And I think sometimes you pick up, literary quarterlies or magazines that publish that, and it's, frankly, you can read it, but I don't think you can read it with any relish. And it very.
Well, I think you're with Carver particularly, you're disturbed by what he writes.
Yeah. But at least Carver's stories have what I would call an afterlife. You think about them afterwards. Whereas there are other writers of minimal fiction where you don't remember them 10 minutes later. I think, to me, that's one aspect of when you put the effort into reading, then you should get something out of it, something other than what you're getting right there. It ought to be something more than a television sitcom, a primetime TV program, which you enjoy while you're watching it, but how many do you remember? And it seems to me that if you're going to put the effort into actually reading a book, then it ought to give you something, and you ought to take something away from it. And unfortunately, again, I've done quite a bit of this kind of reading lately, and it just there's no afterlife.
Well, let's talk about your work. Of course, investments very much concerned with the afterlife. But let's talk first about your first book, The Pull of the Earth. You had really nice blurbs here. Tell me how that book came about. What was that all about?
That book was really about. Well, I'll explain the setting. I'll give you a brief synopsis. It was a little bit like Eugene O'Neill's Desire Under the Elms. It's took place in a rural New England setting, and there was a triangle. Mine was not quite a triangle, it was more like a quadrangle, but at least it had several triangles within that quadrangle. An older farmer, younger wife, and then, in my case, a hired man shows up on this farm. And it's pretty much a tragedy. It's I think I wrote it, aside from the fact that as an attempt to really capture what New England life had been like back in the mid-50s on a farm. It was a very tough life, but it was a very rich life in its own way. And in some ways, this was a kind of archaeology, if you will.
Religious overtones in that book?
Some religious overtones, but I think... Obviously not as marked as Investments. There are some religious overtones there, but it's more, I think it's more a kind of rural tragedy, if you will. It's more the passing of a way of life. It's a country, when the large animal vets go, you don't have them around for your Holsteins anymore. The fields get filled up with houses. A whole kind of personality disappears. And I think it was about that to some extent.
Well, let's talk about vestments. What are vestments?
Vestments are, I would say, are clothes that you put on in a religious sense that define you. That's pretty off the top of my head, but I think in one sense that when somebody puts on anything from a yarmulke to a Roman collar, you are making a statement about yourself and about your beliefs. In a sense, you are identifying yourself. And I think that to some extent is what the book is about. It's about the... we call it haphazard, but the inadvertent putting on of clothes. It's not that inadvertent, but he doesn't mean to do what he does. And the clothes, they start to exert a fairly profound influence, as I think clothes do anyway.
Well, your lead character is a editorial writer or director for a local television station who indeed dons a priest clothing. Well, not completely, I guess. It was just the collar.
Well, he had a black suit, and he had black socks.
I think at one point he goes into a store. Did he actually buy the shirt?
He goes. He eventually buys the shirt, right.
Why would he do something like that? And he is not, obviously, a priest, and he's not even particularly religious.
Well, as you probably know from the novel, he wants to make sure that his aunt, who is dying in a nursing home, who is what you might call pathologically Catholic, if I can use that. I mean, some people get extremely Catholic. She's extremely Catholic, and he thinks she's extremely rich, and he's afraid that he's going to lose the inheritance. So, because she's starting to ask, where is your collar? She had thought that he'd become a priest. Her mind is starting to go. To make sure he gets that, he makes himself a kind of collar using a black turtleneck and some designer tape, which looks pretty good, and he goes to see her dressed like that. What happens is he actually doesn't show her the collar, but he looks at himself in the mirror, and as he's driving around, he likes himself this way. He feels more benign about the world, and the world seems to treat him better. And I guess it becomes a bit of a habit, so to speak. Excuse the pun, no pun intended. It becomes a small vice.
Now, I think if I read in the publicity material correctly, you yourself dressed as a priest. Is that correct?
I did some field research, right?
Now, what was that like? What happened?
In some ways, pretty much what happened in the book. I had a dark suit, almost black suit. I had black shoes, and I went downtown Boston to the clerical supply store, and I bought some. I guess you'd call it a shirt, and which had a tab collar on it. And I came home and put those on. I went out and got in the car, and I drove down the road to a gas station I don't usually use, and I pulled up and I asked him to fill up the car. And this usual sort of slouching teenager was walking over with a dirty rag in his hand, and when he saw the collar, he immediately transformed into this absolutely charming, polite young man who was, can I do this for your father? Can I do that for your father? And it wasn't all that good, but I must say that as I...
Were you propositioned in the combat zone?
No, I was not. But
your
I did walk...
Character is.
My character is. I did walk through the combat zone. And I walked near it. I mean, I sort of walked around downtown Boston, Quincy Market. No, my character is right. There's a lot of good comic possibilities, I think, in having somebody walking around dressed as a priest, who in fact is not a priest, but in fact has a weakness for doing that kind of thing. But I did go to Quincy Marketplace, and I did walk around, and I did find that while most people can take it or leave it, I mean, they don't react one way or another. There are certain people. There were people who seemed attracted to it, who seemed maybe even a little reassured that if when I went into a store to buy, lifesavers, I don't smoke, or something like that, people would there'd be a little exchange in the, you know, how are you doing, Father, and almost you get a sense sometimes that people wanted to talk to you, they felt there was an opening there.
Now, Sebastian, you're Sebastian, correct?
That's right.
Life doesn't go well for him. He loses his job. He loses his love. He begins to drink heavily. Having the garb of a priest certainly didn't help change his life around, did it?
I think it changed his life, but it didn't at least initially change it for the better. I suppose it. What it did is that, in one sense, the book is a reverse of the usual priest book. The usual priest book is you have the priest and he meets a woman and then he leaves the priesthood. Well, in this case, you have somebody who's got a woman, he's got a nice job, he's got a nice apartment, he's got all the things we all want, so to speak, and he finds that it's not enough. That he wants, in a sense, less. But he doesn't know that this is what he wants, and I think this is where the unraveling of his life comes in. He is in a not entirely conscious way jettisoning the parts of his life that that most people take as necessary. His job, his woman, or his significant other, whatever the term is these days. His apartment. All these structures start to crumble around him. It's I think in an unconscious way a kind of willing jettisoning. On the other hand, he's not quite aware of it.
But he does attempt to join the priesthood, or at least he makes stabs at it. Why didn't he do it?
Because as much as he wanted to do it, he still didn't believe. I think one of the conflicts in the book is that as he's going along, as he sets himself up, he likes himself dressed as a priest, he has fantasies about being a priest, he thinks of himself maybe as a Jesuit, an intellectual working in Rome in an old library. He thinks about helping people, all of these good thoughts, but in fact he is, he's like a lot of people, he simply doesn't believe in God. So he doesn't even have the basis for joining the priesthood. And I think one part of the book that people haven't talked about too much is the kind of intellectual scrambling he does to try, in fact, to recreate a God, to try to, in a sense, manufacture one, sort of the old God. You can't find the old God. What does he do? And I think that's one of the main dilemmas of the novel. He's in a sense, put himself very much in limbo.
Well, apparently he must have felt he must feel a tremendous sense of guilt being raised as a Catholic and yet not believing in God and trying to reconcile it. Is that accurate?
At that point, I don't think I suppose if you could talk about it, unconsciously, that's true. But I have a feeling that it's not so much guilt as he's now set himself up for something that he wants. It's as if somebody wanted to join the paratroopers, but couldn't bring himself to jump out of airplanes. He likes the idea of getting up there and putting on all the gear and being with a bunch of tough guys and jumping out of an airplane, but when he gets up there, he just can't do it. I think Sebastian, in some ways, is the same. He wants to be a priest. He likes himself as a priest. He likes the world as a priest. But the basic element, he doesn't have his faith anymore. He's thrown his faith out.
What's going to happen to him now? Next to the last chapter is he hallucinates. Feels that he's plummeting from this smokestack, right? This didn't happen, did it?
No, that didn't happen, but I think that, again, I don't want to give away the great ending, but...
Leave that to me.
Okay.
Let me give it away.
Okay. I think what it is, in some sense, is that the book, at one level, really, it's about redemption. It's about him redeeming his own life. He starts out pretty low character, after all, and I think all the way through. And in some ways, I would like the book to be taken not as a Catholic book, even, or a sectarian book, but one with a sort of a larger message. Message is the wrong word, but a larger import of redemption, of somebody coming around, in a sense, to, a sense that, it's the only life you've got, after all, so far. I mean, and it's in that sense, I use that awful cliche, it is life-affirming. I don't know what else you can say about it.
Well, you can also say that the book is very, very funny. You're not going to sit there and be overwhelmed by... The agony of redemption and this sort of thing.
Well, thank you.
So I think you're not going to laugh all the way through it, but there's so many good episodes, and of course I love the vomiting scene as one of my my favorite scenes. Well, it's a wonderful book, and I enjoyed it very much, and I wish you the best of success with it, and I appreciate very much that you could spend the time talking to me about it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.